We are talking today with Andrew Caton. He is co-author of the book, The Dominion of War, Empire and Liberty in North America, 1500 to 2000. Andrew, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much, Mike. Happy to be in Seattle.
Let me begin and ask you, what was the motivation in writing your book, The Dominion of War?
Well, actually, my co-author, Fred Anderson, at the University of Colorado, and I have been friends for a long, long time, and we always wanted to write, like a lot of young historians, write a big book about American history, and we thought it would be fun to sort of write about North America the way that historians often write about other continents. That is, not to write a book about the U.S. so much, but write about the whole continental history. U.S. historians tend to write about fairly narrow periods of time. We thought it would be a fun to write about a long period of time, and so we started looking around for themes that we could develop, and the two that came to mind most readily were war and empire. So we started actually writing this book, well, probably 10 years ago, and have been working on off and on it with various other projects and so on, and didn't realize how timely it was going to become when we were when we started out.
Did you pick up the pace a little for the current administration to make sure it's timely?
Well, lots of people have picked up the pace for us. I mean, obviously talking about, you say, war, liberty, and empire today, and people's ears perk up. But, you know, one of the things you might want to think about this book is, in a sort of unintended way, is the kind of historical origins of the war in Iraq. That is, the book's not about Iraq, but the book is about the development of the kinds of ideas and tensions and conflicts that lead to the kind of justifications for war that we see today. If you read our book, for example, you'll find that the kinds of things that President Bush talks about today, about liberty and going to war, are as old as the Republic. He's not really saying anything particularly new, not that he claims he is, but he's echoing themes that have existed for 2.5 centuries. And were really probably defined best by people like Andrew Jackson in the early part of the 19th century when they were fighting American Indians.
The title includes the word prominently, dominion. How is it that you chose to use that in the title?
Well, we wanted to use a word that would talk about how important war was, and dominion just had a kind of nice ring to it, but it's meant to suggest the fact that war has been one of the most important themes in the history of North America. This is not a book about celebrating war. This is a book that argues that war is at the heart of American history and American culture, and that war is much more common in the history of the United States than many people think. We tend, I think, in America to think of going to war as strictly defensive things that we do occasionally. We're basically a civilian population, democratic, and we don't go to war until somebody comes up and hits us in the face, and then we go to war to protect ourselves. Now, that's certainly happened, but it's also true that we've gone to war for other reasons as well. And so when you look at the history of North America, you see that oftentimes the greatest periods of social change, discussions about citizenship, what it means to be an American, the way in which the economic system works in the United States, have taken place during and right after wars. Wars are you know, one historian has said, wars are like history on fast forward. They're moments of clarity. There's a kind of urgency about them. You know, people are dying. People want to know why. And when they start asking why these wars, then you often end up with pretty serious, intense conversations about what it means to be an American.
One of the big subjects that comes up in your book is the concept of empire that is getting a lot more play in corporate media of late than it has prior in my lifetime. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, empire is almost a dirty word in American culture, because Americans traditionally don't like to think of ourselves as being an empire. We associate empire with tyranny, empire with the bad guys, the other side. They're the British, they're the Russians, the evil empire. When we say in the book, when Ronald Reagan referred to the Soviet Union's evil empire, in American culture, he was being redundant. You know, empire is, by definition, evil in American history. And Fred and I think that has to do with the fact that the United States was really born in a revolt against empire. And in more than that, in a revolt against power, that Americans traditionally don't like to think of ourselves as powerful people, as a collective. So that, you know, empire basically is a word to use to describe the protection of national interests, the assertion of national power. But when you look at American history, that gets left out most of the time. You know, we use passive voice. North America was settled. Not conquered, which in fact it was. You know, we acquired huge amounts of territory from Mexico because they sold it to us. Well, that's true, but the United States Army was also occupying the capital of Mexico when they sold it to us. So to bring empire into the picture is not to deny the importance of liberty and these other things. It's simply to say, you know, hey, look, it's not one or the other. It's not either we're a liberty-loving people who don't like war, or were these hypocritical people who only fight for oil and economic interests and so on. It's that what is really compelling about the history of North America is the interplay between the two, between empire and liberty. And you could even say some of the most important themes in American history, like between coercion and choice, individualism and responsibility, power and freedom, and war really focuses people's attention on those issues in the ways that peace doesn't usually do it.
We only obviously have a limited amount of time to cover these developments over the last 500 years, but maybe you can kind of give us a flavor of what we're looking at in terms of using war to shape this country early on.
Well, one example would be that to the extent that war plays a role in American history and American culture, people usually focus on three major wars. There's the American Revolution, which created the Republic and is seen as a or explained as a war against tyranny in the form of the British Empire. And some of our most important founding documents, obviously, are statements of liberty against empire, against power, the Declaration of Independence, and so on. The American Civil War, which was seen as a war against slavery, which is a form of tyranny, against the holding of millions of people against their will, and resulted in another great statement of American freedom, which is the Emancipation Proclamation, the abolition of slavery, and so on. And World War II, which a massive mobilization of people to fight fascism and to liberate Europe, which, you know, is a great moment in American history and in history of the world. And it's not our goal to diminish the importance of those wars. What we want to do is to highlight the fact that there are lots of other wars in American history, and that those wars, which seem marginal to us, often seem tremendously important to other people, and were really, in many ways, important in leading to these wars like the Civil War and the American Revolution. So take, for example, the War of 1812, a minor war. Shows up in American history textbooks. It's the kind of thing you skim over in high school. Most people might know that, you know, there was the firing on Fort McHenry and Francis Scott Key wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, that kind of thing. But who knows much about the War of 1812? But if you live in Canada, the War of 1812 is a big war because the United States hoped actually to conquer Canada in the War of 1812 and failed to do so, ending up with the kind of boundary we have between Canada and the United States now. But people wanted to take the North. If you're an American Indian, the War of 1812 is a huge event because Andrew Jackson in the South conquered what is now Alabama and Mississippi and eventually after the war into Florida. So when you think about American history, you think, oh, the War of 1812 is a war against the British. And the big battle, such as there is this famous battle that Andrew Jackson fights in New Orleans in January of 1815, in which, you know, he gets together groups of militiamen all over the lower Mississippi Valley, and this big British army lands that had defeated Napoleon's armies in Europe. And the Americans beat him with very few casualties. And, you know, Jackson celebrated as kind of the natural Democrat. This is the kind of strength of the Democratic people rushing to the defense against the Imperial army that shows up. And that's a great moment in American history. But a year earlier, Jackson's militiamen had surrounded Creek Indians at a place called Horseshoe Bend in Alabama, and 1,000 Creek Indians died. And that victory at Horseshoe Bend led to a treaty by which the Creeks were essentially forced to give up territory to the territory of what is now Alabama and Mississippi. So our point is, you know, look, we need to know about the Battle of New Orleans, but we also need to know about the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. And I think it helps us understand sometimes the difference between intentions and consequences. You know, you can have the noblest of intentions. You can say, well, I believe in liberty and we're coming here to help you out. But people don't always understand or receive those intentions in the same way. So, you know, Indians, you could say to them, as Jackson did in language that echoes what we hear today, well, come be like us. You know, give up your savage ways. Become Christians, Protestants particularly. Adopt white ways of living, accept democracy, and so on. And surprisingly enough, a lot of Indians didn't want to do that. And so they rebelled, resisted what we might today call an insurgency. And Americans traditionally have a hard time dealing with that because we believe, with some justification, that our ideals are so noble, that our intentions are so good. Hey, we're coming to free you. Why wouldn't you want that? That we're baffled and confounded and dumbfounded when people actually fight us. And clearly the same thing happened in Baghdad in the last year and a half and is happening in Iraq, you know, where we show up, get rid of the bad guy. Here we are, freedom. And people say, well, now wait a minute. We don't want freedom the way you define freedom. We want freedom the way we define freedom, which then leads us into the kind of situation we're in Iraq. So if you look at American history, I guess what you would see if you're a student of Iraq is to show that this has happened time and time and time again. Over and over again, the United States will go into some place in a combination of national interest and the cause of liberty, and then end up thinking that it's going to be quick and easy, and being surprised by the tenacity of people who, guess what, feel the same way that Americans felt in 1775, 1776. You know, the British thought in the 18th century they were like the big, you know, symbols of liberty and Protestantism and so on. And the British were, well, what's wrong with these people over there? Why wouldn't they want to be, you know, subjects of the king and British Empire? I mean, this is have the highest standard of living in the world, have freedom more than any other country in the world, which was true. And so what was wrong with these people in America? And the British never quite figured it out, and unfortunately for a lot of Americans, the United States has never quite figured that out as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that a country that was born on a revolution, relatively, has gone out of its way to suppress so many other revolutions, mm-hmm. you know, in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's the tension. That's the problem. As Fred and I try and talk about in the book, The really interesting, compelling, and sometimes dangerous thing about what Americans say about war is not that it's hypocritical. I mean, we don't think that all this talk about liberty is hypocritical, but that it's sincere. People really believe it, and that can ennoble you, but it can also blind you in some way or another. And the problem, the crunch time comes in, okay, if you say to people, we're going to use force to liberate you, and you choose, since as President Bush was talking about in his inaugural address, I think quite eloquently, choice is the essence of freedom. But military power is not about choice. And so if you go into a country like Iraq with military force, overturn a government, and say, we're going to have elections now, with your army still there, you've got tensions, you've got problems. And what do you do if people freely choose to elect a government that may be antithetical to or dangerous to the interests of the United States? So it's not so much that you want to say, you know, people are foolish or hypocritical. I mean, one of the lessons of war is that war rarely ends up where you want it to end up. I mean, it's hard to control. And, you know, in a fancy term, what we call unanticipated consequences. But, you know, you go to war and oftentimes you end up with exactly the opposite of what it was that you were trying to get. And one of the lessons of this book actually is that victory is very dangerous. When you win, sometimes you begin to behave in ways that create all kinds of problems for you that you didn't know.
One of the things that I believe is in your book is the idea that the three noble wars, for lack of a better description, the Revolutionary War, Civil War, and World War II, were actually reactions or unintended consequences of previous smaller, again, for lack of a better word, conflicts. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. And, you know, one of the ways this book is structured, and we did this, was to write it in terms of these kind of mini biographies or sketches of these leading figures in American history. And one of the things that, that showed up when we started to think about it in those terms was the importance of these so-called smaller wars. Give you a big example. The American Revolution, most people know about, or at least they've heard of it. The French and Indian War, which preceded the American Revolution, I don't know that many Americans know much about it. French and Indians, what does that mean? Was that important? Well, our book argues that that war, in many ways, was even more important in some ways than the American Revolution. First of all, it was a global war. It was fought all over the world, in India, in the Caribbean, in North America, in Europe. And what's really interesting about that war is that it was a war for control or dominion of North America between the British and the French and colonists and Indians. And the British won. And when the British won, they were essentially the most powerful nation or empire in the world. And yet within 13 years, they had managed to lose their most valuable colonies. During the French Indian War, which was like 1754 to 1763, Americans fought proud to be British. You know, when the war was over in 63, there was virtually no one who was saying, oh, let's start a new country or republic. We want to be Americans. They wanted to be British. And so one of the things we talk about in the book is how did the experience of the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, then lead Americans to decide that they wanted to set up their own republic? It's another example of this irony here, that the British go to war to get dominion over North America. They win the war in 63, and then within 15 years, they've lost the most important part of it. So in the book, we can take people like George Washington, whose life fits this perfectly. Washington, most famous for, you know, Valley Forge and Yorktown and the American Revolution, actually began his military career fighting for the colony of Virginia in 1754 over control of the Ohio River Valley near what is now Pittsburgh. And he leads some Virginians out there who get into a fight with French and Indians, which actually starts the Seven Years' War. And so the Seven Years' War, as it's called in Europe, or the French and Indian War, you know, occupies most of Washington's 20s and defines the way that he thinks. And he's desperately trying to become a British officer. He's very proud to fight for the king. And yet Washington and lots of other Americans found that when it was over, the British treated them badly. They thought they had, you know, given up their lives and fought for the British crown, and yet they were being treated like riffraff, essentially. Indians, too, in the same way, were upset about the kind of thing. So Washington's life, then, is kind of framed by this imperial war that's between the British and the French, which leads him, ironically, to decide he doesn't want to be part of the British Empire, and he helps lead a revolution. And then he ends his life as President of the United States, presiding over Indian wars in the Ohio Valley and the Great Lakes region, which essentially conquer the remaining Indian tribes in that part of the world. So when you look at Washington's life then as a whole, it's not just about sort of this Virginia planter who was, you know, sitting on his veranda by the Potomac River and hears about Lexington and Concord and rushes to get on his horse and become a great leader of men. This was a man for whom war was probably the most important theme in his life. I mean, he was almost constantly thinking about war. He spent a lot of his life in uniform. And what we found in these other guys that we talked about, U.S. Grant, Jackson, and others, that much of the same kind of thing happened for them.
Yeah, it's interesting for a country that has been crafted so much by war, how many people, citizens, don't seem to recognize how much we have been shaped by war, mm-hmm. and how much we've gained by war, and also the number of leaders that we have put into office that have been military
right.
men.
Right. I mean, war is all about force and coercion, and Americans, quite understandably, don't like force and coercion. And I think it just really goes against the American national self-image and collective self-image to think of us as people who are coercing other people. And you're right about the military leaders, you know, starting with Washington, Jackson, Grant, after the Civil War, a whole string of generals, and Eisenhower, and so on. And indeed, we saw, you know, in the recent election with Bush and Kerry, how important military service can still be, because it's kind of an ultimate test of patriotism, or an ultimate, not so much test, but an ultimate example of your patriotic willingness to fight for your country. But as we saw with Kerry, it gets complicated, because, you know, talking about it in the abstract is one thing, talking about it in the specific, exactly what you did and how you did it and so on, can become very difficult. I think one of the things that's interesting about these generals as presidents is that generals who become presidents tend to be very cautious about using military power. You know, you might expect the reverse, and Jackson's kind of the contrary example, but certainly with Washington and Grant, for example, they knew what war was like, and they were not eager to rush in. They knew, Grant is a good example, that you can lose control of war, that there are unanticipated consequences, that you think you're going to go in and do something, and you end up in a kind of long, drawn-out war with hundreds of thousands of people dead. I mean, you know, when the Civil War started in 1861, most people thought it was going to last a couple of months, a few weeks, and 600,000 men died over the course of the next 4 years. Tens of thousands of people dying in a single day. And Grant saw that. He sent these men to their deaths. And so he said, you know, when he became president, for example, in dealing with Indians on the plains, he was much, much more eager to try and find some kind of peaceful policy rather than go to war. And, of course, the current example would be Colin Powell, who is the last chapter in our book. And I don't think it's any coincidence that Colin Powell, although we don't yet know the full extent of his disagreement with the administration, but there are hints that he was not as enthusiastic about the war in Iraq, let's say, as Donald Rumsfeld was, that he was the one key player who had actually had combat experience. He knows what a war was like. And indeed, we cite one of, from his terrific volume of memoirs, My American Journey, Powell talking about holding a young American who was dying in Vietnam, and Powell talks about how he thought that in the guy's eyes, he calls him a kid, actually, looking at him and saying, why? You know, why is this happening? What happened? Why is this going on? And Powell saying, like many of his generation of officers, saying, this isn't going to happen again. We're not going to get in another war where we don't know why we're fighting or where it's going to go on and on and on and on. And what he developed was something that became known as the Powell Doctrine, which we saw in the first Gulf War, which was, when you go to war with a very specific concrete goal that you can achieve. You use overwhelming force. You make sure you have your allies on your side. You get domestic support. You go in, you get it done, and you get out. The war in Iraq is the opposite of the Powell Doctrine. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to read his second volume of memoirs, where maybe he will talk more candidly about what happened when he was Secretary of State.
Yeah, it's interesting in the current administration that turns out that Colin Powell is basically the, well, in the last administration, that Colin Powell was the dove amongst all the others.
Well, dove may be too strong, but he's certainly more cautious. And again, I think you see that over and over again. Washington, you know, Grant and others, men who've actually been in war are not eager to go back to war. Now, they'll do it, you know, if they think there's no other choice, clearly. But I think, you know, Washington talked all of his life about the experience of the 7 Years' War. And, in fact, one of his few times that he wrote any kind of memoir or autobiography, he wrote about, you know, feeling the bullets and whizzing around him and seeing men die. And with Washington, it's interesting. You know, he lived all of his life and died at the end of the 18th century. And in July, what he remembered was not the 4th of July so much as he remembered the fact that he had fought in a major battle during the French and Indian War in July. And that had become a critical event in his life when he was a young man and shaped much of what he did for the rest of his life. You know, U.S. Grant, another example of the same kind of pattern of Washington. Grant was from Ohio, just sort of an ordinary guy who actually wanted to be a math teacher at a college in Ohio. That was his goal, but he went to West Point. But he began his career as a very young officer invading Mexico during the war with Mexico in 1846 and 7, ends up in Mexico City with the occupying army. And that event of serving in that war stayed with him for the rest of his life. He, like William Tecumseh Sherman, who was in the army but not actually in Mexico, part of what they decided with the Civil War was something not that far from the Powell Doctrine in a way, which was, if you're going to do it, you do it. You do it overwhelmingly. You do it quickly. You make your you get in and you get out. And so Grant and Sherman and these other Civil War generals who were successful would say, you know, you take overwhelming force and you batter it and you win and you make your point that they accept the fact that they lost, and then you go home. So you can have this kind of juxtaposition of someone like Sherman, who arrives in Columbia, South Carolina in 1865, and the war's pretty much over by that point. And Columbia, South Carolina was where secession had been voted. South Carolina was the first state to secede from the Union, and a fire starts, and the city is engulfed in flames, and, you know, one of his officers says, you know, General, should we do something about this? And Sherman just stands there and says, you know, they brought it on. This is the price they pay. Or more famously, he said, war is hell. Now, he didn't say that because he was happy about it. He said, it's supposed to be hell. And you don't go in to be nice to people. You go in to force them to say, you can't do this. You have to do what we want you to do. And you make your point. But then when the war is over, both Grant and Sherman, much to everybody's surprise, turned out to be incredibly magnanimous victors. You know, at Appomattox, Grant basically lets Lee and his army go home and take their sidearms with them and everything else, because he and Sherman believed once people clearly accepted the outcome, there was no point in retribution. You know, go home. You know, this has been awful and terrible. Let's go back and get back to our lives. So they could sort of hold this in their heads that while the war is on, it's meant to be hell. It's meant to be terrible. But once the other side says, okay, you win, then, you know, you go back to being as peaceful as you possibly can be.
I've read that back at about the period of World War One, when wars were fought, state wars were fought, that the casualties tended to be 80-90% were military forces, and 10-20% tended to be civilians. And now we're looking at today's wars where it's flip-flopped. Mm-hmm. But in looking at your book, it reminded me that when we were slaughtering natives in this country, that was a lot of civilians that we were going in. Can you give us some perspective on if you've run across...
You mean actual numbers?
Numbers or percentages or... I mean, is that true, that 80-20 split?
Well, that's a fairly common division in terms of the way that people think about it. I mean, in these Indian wars, it's very hard to come up with an exact number, because who was a civilian and who was not? You're talking a lot about of the European Americans who were, you know, soldiers one day and farmers the next. And the same thing was true of Indians, by the way, as well. And indeed, most Indians die from disease. They die from the disease that Europeans brought with them, and another kind of unexpected consequence of discovery. But I think one of the things, obviously, is that today we have a very steady account of how many Americans are killed in action, but the number of Iraqis who die is largely unknown, I think, or maybe somebody does know, but it's very hard to actually tell. We're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of people probably who've lost their lives. But I think it's one of the ways in which the United States deals with war. We keep the focus very strictly on ourselves, and we don't always see the consequences of what we're doing on other people.
Is the U.S. unique in that, our view of pretty much ignoring what we do to others in these wars?
No, I don't think so. But I think most empires globalize their values. You know, I mean, you don't talk about American rights, you talk about human rights. You don't talk about American liberty, you talk about universal cause of liberty or something like that. And in that way, the United States is no different, let's say, than Rome and the Empire of Rome. You know, most empires believe that they're bringing civilization and prosperity and so on to other kinds of people. But I think we live in a different time. And I think one of the things that, you know, that is good about the United States is that there's a lot of interest in understanding other people. And I think, you know, it's not a simple solution. Again, it's not an either or thing. But I think, for example, if we spent more time thinking about why other people in the world don't like us, 9/11 was a horrific, terrible event, and Americans had every reason in the world to be angry and sad and just confounded and wanting to lash out about that. And I don't want to minimize that one bit. But at the same time, I think it might be useful to think a little bit about why that happened in the first place, rather than just saying, well, it's a bunch of crazy fanatics. I think that's part of the problem throughout American history, is that the assumption is that people want the kind of freedom we want, which is capitalism and a kind of democratic government, largely Christian and even more Protestant, if you want to get specific about it. And so we assume, well, there are evil people, you know, a small clique of evil guys, and they're for evil purposes. And it's almost a comic book kind of version of history, you know, the bad guy. And if you can find the bad guy who's spewing propaganda and brainwashing people and misleading them, then everything will be right with the world. And this happened, you know, I mean, it happened in Europe in 1944 and 1945. But, you know, one of the great debates, obviously, still about the 20th century is the degree to which in Germany or in Russia this was simply a matter of a few people at the top who were in control, or whether large numbers of people were actually involved and complicit in this kind of thing. It also gets to be a problem when you're dealing with people who are not European or of European descent. And, you know, it's no coincidence that the so-called good wars, the Civil War, the American Revolution, and the World War II, are fought with people and by people and against people of European descent, where there are traditions, parliamentary traditions, legal traditions, cultural traditions that are very much in common. The problem usually comes in when you're dealing with people who are not from the same tradition, who are dark-skinned, who are Catholic in the 19th century, as Mexicans were, or who were Muslim. People whose customs and values are different. You know, and President Bush, again, to his credit, and I think very eloquently, talked about this in his inaugural address when he talked about, you know, again, freedom is about choice, and people may well choose to live their lives in ways that we don't particularly like. Again, in the abstract, I think that's totally noble. But in specific, concrete terms, again, if you elect a government that the United States believes is dangerous to the United States, are we really going to just stand back and say that's okay with us? So it's again a question of not thinking about empire or liberty. We're all bad or we're all good, or it's all about oil or it's all about freedom. But trying to see that this is a kind of fluid situation in which these impulses to national power and protection and to universalize liberty are constantly in flux with each other. And I think the lesson of war, the lesson of the Dominion War more than anything else, is to take several deep breaths before you do anything. Because 9 times out of 10, you're not going to achieve what it is that you want to achieve. And if the lesson of the British in the 1760s, the lesson of the United States government with the Mexican War in the 1840s, of the United States in the Philippines, all of these wars, the lessons of it are that they often turn out in ways nobody could have imagined when they started. And you often, in some cases, and there's a report recently that Iraq has now become the most important breeding ground of terrorists in the world. Well, the war was intended to do exactly the opposite. And yet, you know, what you do in some ways by going to war is actually, and I think we have done this in Iraq, is to create a lot of more enemies for the United States than there were when you started.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Andrew Caton. He is co-author of the book The Dominion of War, Empire and Liberty in North America, 1500 to 2000. Can you talk a little bit about the Mexican-American War? I find it interesting and incredibly hypocritical, like our immigration focus on, right. Oh, let's stop Mexicans from coming into the U.S.
Right, which was originally Mexico.
Mexico.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, the Mexican War, you know, I sound like a broken record here, but the Mexican War is another example of the same kind of pattern. Here you got lots of Southerners, particularly in the 1830s and 40s, who wanted to expand to the South and West. I mean, these guys actually, some of them wanted to annex Cuba. They wanted to take over Central American states. They wanted to turn the Gulf of Mexico into kind of a big American lake with all these Southern states down there, with whites obviously dominating and large numbers of Hispanic and Black people as laborers in plantations and mines and things like that. And, of course, they would talk in terms of freedom and liberty, white American Southerners in the tradition of Andrew Jackson. But what they were really talking about was the liberty and independence of white Protestant Southern males. So there was this huge effort and interest in getting Texas and in getting more territory from Mexico. And that's what the Mexican War was all about. I mean, the United States had annexed Texas. Texas had obviously declared its independence in 1836. But, you know, Texas was part of a Mexican state in the Mexican Republic. And when Santa Anna, the famous Mexican president general, came to suppress the rebellion in Mexico, he was doing what Mexican presidents did a lot of. Now, not to condone it, but what he was doing was essentially was putting down another rebellion in a distant province. And the Alamo, you know, in 1836 is a classic example of what Fred and I are talking about in this book. These men died, outnumbered, and their stance is noble, and they talk a great deal about how they're fighting for liberty and independence. And remember, the Alamo becomes a great cry of American independence and liberty, where these guys are slaughtered by this huge 6,000-man army. But the fact of the matter is that the Americans were on Mexican soil. They were in rebellion against a government in Mexico City. They were slaveholders, many of them, and they were not there for benign purposes. Mexico, so it's an example of, without saying, oh, the guys at the Alamo were really ignoble hypocrites, but saying, you know, look, there's a Mexican side to this story, too, and that side needs to be told. Anyway, that led to this big war in 1846, 47, 8, which Americans don't know very much about unless you're Mexican-American. Again, like the War of 1812 was a huge war in Canadian history. The war with Mexico was a huge war in Mexican history. The United States invades, conquers the country, takes over the government, occupies Mexico City in 1847, and basically forces a new Mexican government to sign the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, by which the United States buys, quote unquote, what we now call California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, parts of Colorado, Texas, and so on. Huge land grab. Now, if you were studying European history, you know, you would talk about that as a major event. But in American history, again, because we don't like to think of ourselves as conquerors, and because we like to think of ourselves as people who only fight for defensive purposes, it causes all kinds. So, you know, we sort of shove it off to the side. You know, we put up a big monument to World War II on the Mall in D.C., but there's not a great monument to the Mexican War. And it's not just, you know, Fred and I are hardly the first. It's not just historians who said this. I mean, I mentioned earlier that Grant was with this army. And in his memoirs, Grant wrote that the Mexican War was the most immoral and unjust war ever waged by one people against another. And he participated in it. But he himself described it as nothing more than a naked grab for power and land. You know, Abraham Lincoln, who was a congressman, stood up in Congress and denounced the war and attacked President Polk, who was the President of the United States at the time. And I think that's another thing, by the way, that we need to stress and that we talk about in the book, is that there's lots of opposition to this in the United States. War is not always unanimously popular, and peace movements are very powerful. I think one of the things that people might find interesting in the new book is the extent to which that that division reflects even today the kind of what we call red state, blue state America, is that traditionally in the red states, war has traditionally been more popular, or at least more widely accepted. Or to put it another way, you find more anti-war movements, more dissidents, more critics of American military ventures in places like Boston and New York and California and the northern Midwestern states than you do in any other part of the country. So, you know, the Mexican War, the United States acquires almost half of the Republic of Mexico. And what it does in another unanticipated way was that here's this war designed to complete American dominion over North America. We get this territory, but what it does is to make slavery a political issue that will not go away, because this new territory has to be slave or free as being admitted into the United States. Texas and California are the way they are as a result of a compromise. You know, rather than divide California into three states or Texas into four or five states, you have one big slave state and one big free state, California. But anyway, the Mexican War then sets into motion the kind of conflicts and debates that eventually drive Americans apart and produce this huge war over exactly what it means to be an American in 1861-65. So, another ironic consequence.
Well, you talked about the amount of opposition that came up during that particular war. Can you give us a sense for, historically, with the opposition to the current war in Iraq, how that rates, maybe, or compares with opposition with other wars? Has there always been a vocal debate in the past? It seems like there wasn't, certainly at the congressional level, there wasn't nearly as much debate on this current conflict as what I remember from in the past.
I think there's less, what's the right word to put it? There's less kind of people in the streets protesting this war. I mean, there are some, but not to the extent. But I think there are probably that misgivings about this war are broader and deeper than they have been in other contests. I think that's one of the reasons why there's this such a serious sense of division between people, between red state and blue states and that kind of thing, is that, I mean, even some of the people who voted for President Bush last fall had serious reservations about whether or not we ought to be in Iraq. And I guess I would say I don't think there's as much overt screaming about it as there would be, say, with Vietnam, although that may still come, as there is just widespread uneasiness. But your point about, you know, opposition is that that's as old as the Republic. I mean, my God, you know, again, here, you know, the cliche is winners write history. Well, of course they do. But in the American Revolution, you know, John Adams' old line that one-third, one-third, one-third is probably roughly accurate. That is, you know, one-third of the people who lived in the colonies were Tories, loyalists. They didn't want to fight the king. And indeed, some estimates say of 100,000 people left the American colonies to go to Great Britain or go to British Canada or something like that. The War of 1812, huge opposition. You've got some New Englanders talking kind of wildly briefly about secession because they were opposed to the war. The Mexican War, again, in New England and the Northeast, particularly strong opposition to it. During the American Civil War, large numbers of Northerners were opposed to the war, voted for the Democratic candidates called Copperheads. You had a crazy case of a Copperhead politician from Ohio who was a peace Democrat running for governor of Ohio from Windsor, Ontario, Canada, because he was, you know, would have been arrested had he been in Ohio. And he got lots of votes. He didn't win, but he got lots of votes. And you know, so on. The Spanish-American War gave rise to the Anti-Imperial League. Again, many of them in Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, places. Probably the only war that would be exceptional in that regard is World War II. And even there, you know, there was some particularly before the war and right up until Pearl Harbor, isolationist people, conservatives who were opposed to the war. But I would say with the exception of World War II, criticism of war, dissent from war have been incredibly powerful. And, you know, and what Fred and I say is in the book is that is an example of what I was talking about earlier, which is that it's part of the dominion of war, that it's during war, again, that Americans feel like there's so much on the table and there's so much at stake that they're willing to sort of come out and speak and get angry with each other and talk and fight because, you know, in peace and prosperity, you can worry about things. But when people are dying, people you know, and when you're paying in ways for people who are being killed, you want to know the answer to that question that soldier asked of Colin Powell. Why? And that leads into really, I think, important conversations about power and liberty and empire and all these other kinds of things that we're having today. So actually, I think this is all, you know, a very healthy kind of discussion in the long run.
Well, another trend that I know has happened during the numerous wars, at least during the more well-known ones, is the fact that the given administration in power tends to clamp down on public debate. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the Patriot Act is actually a pretty mild version of that. You can go through, I mean, Lincoln, the great emancipator, suspended the writ of habeas corpus, threw critics in jail, escorted people out of the North to Confederate lines. You know, again, you could go World War I, the Red Scare right after the war, after World War II, I think these are related. You have another kind of Red Scare. Yeah. And that's usually, again, justified as part of the empire equation. It's necessary for people to give up some of their individual rights in order to protect the country as a whole. But, and here's where I think our point about empire and liberty, not empire or liberty, becomes really critical. Not only are wars periods in which you see the most repressive moments in American history, they're also the periods in which you see the greatest legal expansions of liberty in American history. You know, I just said Lincoln cuts down, suspends the writ of habeas corpus, arrests people, journalists, and so on. But it's also true that the Civil War ends slavery. And the Civil War results in an amendment to the Constitution abolishing slavery and in establishing equal rights before the law. World War I, you know, oppression, repression, and Red Scare. Women get the right to vote in 1919. World War II, yes, the same thing. Red Scare, McCarthyism, and all that other kind of stuff after the war, but also the Civil Rights Movement. I don't think it's any coincidence that Harry Truman desegregates the military after World War II, and that's one of the first places it actually happens in the United States, because war brought out the contradiction. Wait a minute, you know, we're fighting for liberty against tyranny. We're sending our sons and daughters to die against the Japanese and against fascists in Germany and so on. And yet, you know, we don't accord these people full rights. You know, I mean, that's a concrete example of how war focuses something. Now, it's not to say that, you know, desegregation wouldn't have happened eventually, but that war makes it so obvious, so urgent, so in everybody's face that you can't avoid it. And again, you know, in Vietnam, the same kind of thing, where you have lots of repression, but at the same time, you have the anti-war movement, you have a tremendous expansion in women's rights and in minorities and civil rights movement and so on. So, I mean, if you were predicting this, and of course, being a historian, you can't predict it, but you would think that the Iraqi business would not only lead to the kind of repression that people talk about, but by sparking debate, by pointing out contradictions, by raising issues that people tend to ignore in peacetime, you know, it may well be that the spirit of the sphere of liberty will be expanded in some kind of institutional way over the next few years.
Can you give us a sense, historically, over the last 500 years, the scope of the, for lack of a better word, military profiteers that are very dominant in our economy now, mm-hmm. almost the driving force in our economy? Has that always been the case?
Well, not to the extent that it is today, but clearly there are a lot of economic interests involved in war. And part of it is the kind of thing that once it gets started, it's like anything else. It becomes self-sustaining. And the biggest and best example of that is probably World War II, where you mobilize the whole country, you produce all these planes and guns and everything else. And when the war is over, corporations and people in general just don't want to close them up and go back. So you look for reasons to keep keep them going. And but I, you know, again, I think it's not coincidental that it was a general, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who warned us about this when he left office, the military-industrial complex, as he called it. And I think one of the things that Eisenhower was pointing out, and one of the long traditions in American history, is not just the profiteering angle of it, but the notion of a kind of standing military establishment, both economic and professional, which Americans have traditionally felt very, very, very uncomfortable with. But today, of course, the economic interests of corporations is so mixed up in all this stuff in all kinds of complicated ways, from the internet through computers and all kinds of stuff, that it's almost difficult. It's much more difficult to separate it out today than, say, it would be in the Civil War when the Colt Company obviously was making a lot of money off of the selling of pistols and rifles during the Civil War.
Any parallel examples to financial interests of specifically people in the White House? For example, let's say Dick Cheney and Halliburton profiting from the current conflict?
Well, you know, I mean, again, it's hard to draw that kind of direct parallel in the past because, well, it just wasn't the same situation. I mean, clearly people like George Washington thought he would benefit economically from the independence of the United States. And the people who were the leaders of the American Revolution thought that. I mean, I think one of the things that happened in 19th century America was that up until the early 1800s, there was a pretty much a direct overlap between powerful economic people and powerful political people. That is, the people who were prominent politically and militarily were also prominent economically. Like George Washington was a huge landowner and a real estate speculator on a grand scale in the 18th century. But in the early 19th century, one of the things that happened was that those people who were powerful economically didn't have time for politics. It became kind of a sideshow. It wasn't profitable for them. It took away time that could be devoted to developing railroad corporations and other kinds of things. And so they began essentially to hire lawyers to do that work for them. And I mean, Lincoln is a good example. And Lincoln is actually my personal hero, to the extent that I have one in American history, and certainly an American president. But there's no doubt but that Lincoln's policies as a military leader, and certainly during the Civil War, he and his party, the Republican Party, while the South was out, I mean, imagine this today. If you could take the red states out of the Union for 5 years and have a Congress that was only made up of senators and congressmen from those states that voted for Kerry, you'd pass a lot of legislation in 4 years, and a lot of things would change. And so during the Civil War, you know, the chartering railroad companies like the Union Pacific, the Land Grant Act that creates colleges, raising the tariff, I mean, all these kinds of economic things, corporations benefit, guys who make money on the war railroad will have names like Rockefeller, like Carnegie and others. So, and leads to, you know, what in a kind of oversimplification, people often referred to as robber barons and so on in the late 19th century. So, yeah, I mean, even the poor little old War of 1812, by cutting off trade with Great Britain, gives a major stimulation to the Industrial Revolution in New England, production of cotton textiles along the rivers of New England and so on. So wars are intimately related to economic development, and some people do benefit, obviously, far more than other people. I'm not sure, however, we've seen anything quite as direct as what we see going on today in the White House.
All right. We just have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts you'd like to leave with listeners.
I mean, I hope, if anything else, that one of the things this book will do, and I know this is a kind of pipe dream, is that it will help people. Those people who are interested in avoiding kind of soundbite answers to problems, that it has to be one way or the other, and that you have to be able to answer all problems in 10 seconds or fewer, I think one of the ways that, that might be useful as Americans is if we stop thinking of ourselves as being good or bad, evil or noble, and instead saw ourselves as another country, another empire in the history of the world, like others. Sometimes we're different, sometimes we're not. That is, we can look critically at our history and think about the complexities of our history without being unpatriotic, without calling into question all the kinds of tremendous advances that the United States has stood for. But more than anything else, to remind ourselves that probably the most important thing that we have to do as citizens of the United States is to question and challenge and think and try and see the past and the present and the future as contingent and fluid, and that debate is at the core of that. We need to argue with each other.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much, Mike. I enjoyed it.
We have just been talking with Andrew Caton. He is co-author of the book, The Dominion of War, Empire and Liberty in North America, 1500 to 2000.